Arthur Machen once wrote that strange things are lost and forgotten in obscure corners of the newspaper. This podcast will aim to prove that that statement is true.
Hello, and welcome to episode 10 of Forgotten Darkness. I'm Andrew Gable. The next story comes from the nation's capital, which, allow me to say, I discovered as I was researching this episode contains some of the most confusing addresses I've ever heard. Nearly every street address given in news coverage of this event had two locations with the exact same address. And then further research would be needed to try to determine which of the two was meant. It was all very confusing. Back in episode 3, which was about Jack the Shoe Slasher of Philadelphia and Baltimore, I had mentioned how, capitalizing on the impact of the Jack the Ripper killings a few years before, and presumably to give newspapers a convenient, punchy name to refer to a criminal as, there were so many offenders in the Victorian era that were given the name Jack the X whatever. This particular criminal was one of those called Jack the Slasher. Although, contrary to the name, he never slashed anyone. You'll see what I mean. The first that was heard of the offending vandal was in September of 1893. The officers' quarters at Fort Myer, Virginia, were ransacked. Hundreds of dollars in damage was done, but details are sketchy. In October 8, Nicholas E. Young, president of the National Baseball League and employee of the Treasury Department, reported that his house in the Mount Pleasant section of the city, just east of Rock Creek Park, had been broken into. The slats of the shutters were carefully removed, and then the intruder had shimmied in through the window. But the scene was not what one would expect from an apparent robber. As it was described in the 1894 Police Department retrospective, the bric-a-brac and furniture therein were almost completely destroyed. The primary object of the entry seemed to have been damage to the household effects. The walls and pictures were besmeared with mud, while chairs and carpets were cut with a keen knife. A silver watch and a few other small items had been stolen, but not a motive could be ascribed, bizarre vandalism that had taken place. A few days later, the home of a Judge Miller in Tacoma Park, Maryland, was entered. Tapestries and carpets were slashed, paintings were defaced, the upholstery on the chairs was befouled with dirt, and a pile of new clothing belonging to Mrs. Miller was gathered up and thrown into the backyard. The home of naval employee Floyd T. Frost was broken into on November 4th, the burglars having bored a hole in the back door and reached through to unlock the door. Small items were nabbed from the parlor, dining room, and kitchen, but vandalism in the vein of that which had taken place in the Young and Miller households was also committed. As the report said, the curtains and furniture were cut and ruined, and the lard and butter from the pantry were smeared over the piano, walls, and carpets. Although by this time it had been noted that the offender, whoever he was, never actually harmed anyone, women, especially, were agitated, since most would perhaps take the chances of injury to themselves as readily as they would suffer their new dress and fall bonnet to fall under the burglar's knife. It didn't take long for hysteria to set in, and already within a few weeks of the initial break-ins, all manner of false sightings and encounters were reported. In one instance, nothing had been present at all, and in another, the sound of the victim's dog scratching at the carpets was mistaken for the sound of a knife slashing the carpets. The head of the D.C. Detect Force, L.H. Hollenberger, recommended that detectives patrol the street in civilian clothing so as not to arouse suspicion. Some news sources claim that no less a home than the White House itself was entered by the mysterious vandal. Although in an all-too-familiar distrust of anything the government says, upon an official denial of this by White House staff, the San Francisco Examiner said that notwithstanding the denial, it is known to be a fact that his depredations in the executive mansion were exactly as detailed, and the denial is only for the purpose of quieting the minds of those frightened at the deafness by which this eccentric individual appears in various places. It cited a November 17th story coming from Washington, and as a result, guard at the White House was doubled. On November 17th, the day which the San Francisco paper said the article referencing Jack's depredations at the White House was referenced, there was an article in the Washington papers detailing a series of break-ins on Capitol Hill. First hit was the tailor shop of Benjamin and Jacob Schwartz at 337 Pennsylvania Avenue Southeast. Police also found an overcoat discarded in the backyard of Schwartz's, apparently disposed of by the robber once he had stolen a new one. Then the robber hit the Ferdinand Frank shoe store a few doors down the street at 333 Pennsylvania Avenue Southeast and stole a pair of shoes. In the initial reportage, however, there was nothing to suggest that this was particularly thought to be the work of Jack. With the mentions of Pennsylvania Avenue and Capitol Hill, I'm wondering if this is what led to the story that Jack had visited the White House. Or it may be other events which will come up later. Also noted was the effects of the slasher hysteria on the local economy. The purchase of burglar alarms and additional locks and bolts of late by the aroused householders gladdens the hearts of the hardware dealer to an extent never before known here, and more than one dealer has been required to hire additional clerks to meet the increasing demands of his customers. The gas company is also reaping an unexpected harvest, for in hundreds of homes, the gas burns all night long because of the exploits of the nocturnal burglar. Soon after, he visited the house of Samuel Johnson at 427 7th Street Southeast. One of the households that had been in fear of Jack, the Johnsons had already moved some of their valuables from the first floor to the second floor, so as they might not be stolen as easily. Mr. Johnson went to the barber's in the evening, and his wife went to visit a neighbor. She returned home at about 7:30 in the evening to another bizarre scene. As it was described in the newspapers, having entered the kitchen, the vandal proceeded to make a mixture of the meat, vegetables, butter, and lard, and then poured kerosene over the pile. Two table covers that had been left over a pan of dough were slashed, and a glass of molasses found in the kitchen was used on the chairs. All the curtains, upholstery, paintings, and tablecloths in the dining room had also been cut to ribbons, and the rags thrown in a heap on the floor. On November 19th, the home of a Mrs. Keith, at the corner of Rockville Pike, which is now Wisconsin Avenue, and Woodley Road in Tenleytown, was hit. The window had been unlatched, and it was opened, but then for good measure, the robber had also opened the back door. The scene at the Keith home was described. Phoebe Murray, one of the collared domestics in the house, was about the last one to retire. She was asleep in her room when the visitors reached the house. Her apartment was first visited, and it is thought that she was chloroformed. The bureau drawers were also quietly removed, but in order to do this, the men had to almost touch the bed in which the woman was soundly sleeping. In these drawers, Phoebe had all her good clothes, and they were taken to the yard below and slashed in such a manner that needles and thread cannot repair the damage. But an elderly collared woman in an adjoining room was also visited, and some of her clothing removed and left in the pile of rags in the yard. Jack had also hacked and cut some flowers that had been in an upstairs hallway. Shortly after this, the house of Henry Vogt, near St. Albans Episcopal Church in Tenleytown, was also visited. The offender began to cut his way in through the window, but had apparently been scared off before he could gain entry. Early on the morning of the 20th, H.C. Holdridge of 809 18th Street Northwest, only blocks from the White House, informed police about a suspicious individual loitering around the homes. Police arrived to find that the back doors and windows of four adjacent homes, 811, 813, 815, and 817, had been cast open, as if someone intended to gain entry, but had not actually done so. A William Goodwin and Patrick Henry Moran, both of whom were dishonorably discharged from the 7th Cavalry at Fort Myer, Virginia, were arrested on suspicion of robbery. It was later proven in court that they had pawned a number of expensive-looking items, and they were also spending money extravagantly. A diner owner named James Hogan testified that Goodwin looked shocked and dropped his knife and fork when he mentioned that Jack the Slasher should be shot if found. There was an attempt to link these two to the earlier Fort Myer incidents in September. That same morning, three homeless men, Charles Brown, a.k.a. Charles Lane, Richard Brown, a.k.a. George Carter, and James Brown, were arrested in a trash dump. The vagrants were found to have in their possession a pocket knife and a putty knife, which had blood on it, as well as a few other insignificant articles. The men were held. The arrest of these men led the police to conduct a sweep of a homeless camp along the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad near Long Bridge, so just south of the Jefferson Memorial, in hopes that there was some information to be gained about the arrested men. 12 men were arrested overall, but no relevant information was obtained. All were released, including, eventually, the three had been picked up in the trash dump. In late November, the offices of the Washington Daily Star received a letter, ostensibly from the bandit, who by now was called Jack the Slasher. It implied him to be part of a gang and threatened the life of the president. Some explanation of the letter is needed. Mr. Cleveland, obviously, is referring to President Grover Cleveland. Carter Harrison was the 5 times elected mayor of Chicago, who had been assassinated just a month before. The text of the letter is slightly cleaned up here to make it a bit more intelligible to the listener. It was written like many of the Jack the Ripper letters in 1888, in a very subliterate style, which was absolutely rife with misspellings and random capitalization, and to be honest, the language itself didn't even make a whole lot of sense. Washington, D.C., November 20th. Please put this in your paper. Why, they think they got Jack the Slasher, but they have not. And for Mr. Cleveland, he better look sharp and keep his eyes skinned, for we will fix it for him next now. As time is, he's going fishing and hunting, and poor people are starving to death, and all his bodyguard will not save him. And we will raise hell before we get through yet, and we will show you all that the police is no good. And for them men you all think is the men, is the wrong men, and not the right men at all. If it don't be a change, it is going to be hell, and Cleveland will fare like that damn Carter Harrison did, the damn beat. Beware to me, for me and my gang are gonna set this damned town on fire. Please keep a good look, for more you look, the less you will see. From a friend, Jack the Slasher. Underneath the text of the letter was a sketch of a skull and crossbones, and beneath that were the words, "You can copy and be damned." An old military man, E.L. Springman, on the night of the 21st, heard someone trying to enter his house through the kitchen. He grabbed his old military saber and went out to meet who he supposed to be the infamous Jack. But after knocking the man climbing in his window over the head with the pommel of the sword, he discovered it was only a neighbor of his, hopelessly drunk. On the morning of November 22nd, policeman Charles B. Terry shot a 19-year-old black man named Willis Washington on U Street Northwest near 14th Street. Terry and his partner, a William Skirman, were patrolling the area in search of Jack, keeping an especial eye on the backs of homes, as Jack always gained entry in this way. They saw a man walking on the street at about 3:30 a.m., who they thought acted suspiciously once he saw the officers, and as, quote, they were reasonably certain that the man could give no good account of his presence at that hour, they called out to him, and he refused to stop. Terry pulled his gun and fired at the ground, and the man kept moving, and so he shot him. When asked why he was running, Washington said, "'Cause I thought you was doctors." And although some newspapers questioned why he had such a fear of the medical profession, most people familiar with urban legends and things of the time won't find it too strange, because the urban legend of the night doctors, doctors who would accost blacks and use them for all manner of medical experimentation, was a prevalent one in Washington, D.C. The man was conveyed to the hospital, where it was found he had a severe spinal injury. Terry was placed under arrest. He had only been an officer a short while, but he had already been rather violent during the arrest of a man named Meany, and had also been previously tried for shooting at a black man. Terry made bail and was released on December 18th, though he was suspended without pay. His trial took place in May of 1894. He was sentenced to serve 3 years in prison for the shooting, and was brought out of prison to stand trial once again, once Washington died on October 9th, 1894. It was eventually decided that the death of Willis Washington was not the result of the gunshot wound inflicted by Charles B. Terry, and that from evidence adduced, we believe the death to be from edema of the lungs as the result of the autopsy showed. Terry was remanded to jail to serve the remainder of his sentence and returned to duty in 1897. Later, on the 22nd, SS Shedd's stables at Tacoma Park were broken into, and the clothing belonging to an employee of his, a George Bowman, was stolen. It was reported that this, though, was later proven to not be the work of Jack. That evening, also, the slaughterhouse of George Wells on Conduit Road, which is modern-day MacArthur Boulevard, near the distributing reservoir, by which is meant the Washington Aqueduct Reservoir, which is usually known as the Georgetown Reservoir, was broken into and some of the meat taken from the shelves and chopped into pieces. This again was believed to have been a copycat and not the quote-unquote authentic Jack. November 24th saw the appearance of a bedraggled man, a pestiferous crank, according to the press, at the White House. White House security in 1893 must not have been what it is today. The man introduced himself as John Carton, an old personal friend of President Cleveland, and then he made his way into the White House and ran up a private stairwell before being stopped. He claimed that the spirits told him to go see Cleveland and get the $10,000 he claimed was personally owed to him. Even while he was being led away by the police, he called out to the security detail that he would be back to receive the money later. It eventually came out that he had been an inmate in an asylum in New Jersey, but had been discharged as cured. This is another piece that may have contributed to the rumor discussed earlier, that Jack had gained entrance to the White House, for the press seemed to be attempting to connect Carton to that case. Jack himself finally reappeared on November 30th, entering the home of A. Sanford Gorman, at 3419 S Street Northwest in Georgetown, as it was described. On the table, Mrs. Gorman had left several pieces of new dress goods, including silks and other materials. These are now not fit for the junk dealer. The carpet on the floor suffered several strokes, while the seat of the large sofa was slashed and the feather filling removed. Besides this, the early morning visitors slashed the mats on the floor, ruined the chairs, and even the plants at the front window did not escape his knife. The feathers from the sofa were scattered around the room, giving the place the appearance of a hen house after the visit of a chicken thief. A small patch of carpet was taken from Gorman's home, but no valuables were stolen. The stables at the neighboring house, belonging to an L.E. Mortal, were also vandalized. It is unknown why Jack passed up entering the house, and instead decided on the stable. But at any rate, he wildly slashed and hacked the top sides and curtains of Mr. Morville's carriage, and cut the reins for the horses in two. Time was even taken to hack one spoke from each wheel. Another house in Georgetown was visited, and displayed damage to the outside, but was not actually entered. Jack himself took a break for the holidays. But there was a notable instance of imposture just before Christmas. A Mrs. Samuel Phones of Alexandria, Virginia, left a number of cakes which she had baked for church on the kitchen table overnight, and when she awoke, she found to her dismay that someone had broken in overnight and thrown all the cakes into the backyard. On January 21st, the home of Mrs. A.E. Wall, on the corner of 4th Street and West Street Northwest, which was called Pomeroy Street in 1894, was broken into. $70 was missing from a downstairs drawer, although bizarrely, silverware which was sitting in the dining room was untouched. The dining room and parlor were covered in feathers from pillows that had been ripped open, and beads from a nearby drawer were cast all over the downstairs. The carpets, sofas, and several items of clothing were slashed. A clock was smashed and the pieces thrown into the backyard. Two servants, Millie Bailey and Isaiah Johnson, were initially arrested but later released. Several tramps who lived in the vicinity of the house, Willis Devine, Nellie Dennis, and Willis Johnson, were also brought in. Dennis and Johnson were soon released, and Devine held after it was determined that he had threatened Mrs. Wall on a previous occasion, but he later was released. Around 2:30 a.m. on the morning of March 8th, the home of Colonel DeWitt C. Sprigg at 1107 Harvard Street Northwest was broken into. Sprigg had been wounded at the First Battle of Bull Run, was a former military consul, and a prominent Washington lawyer. Mrs. Sprigg awoke to notice that a lamp in the upstairs hall was being turned down, and she called out to her husband, thinking it was him that was doing it. She received no answer, but caught a glimpse of a man fleeing down the hall and descending the stairs. The burglar escaped before Mr. Sprigg, who was sleeping in another part of the house, awoke. Later, it was discovered that the shutters on one of the rear windows was slashed and the window pried open. Two sets of footprints were discovered outside by police. Also noted was that the house had an odd smell, which was believed to have been from some drug carried by the burglars for the purpose of rendering unconscious the inmates of the house. About 2 hours later, Mrs. Milton M. Holland was awoken by one of her children, and in a moment frantically awoke her husband, a lawyer, for she had seen a man crouched in the darkness with a heap of clothing and jewelry on the floor before him. Holland testified in court that he hit the intruder with a chair, and that the robber then fled as Holland tried to find his gun to no avail. By the time he did, the man was nowhere to be seen. He went outside and found some of his business cards scattered all over the road. He followed the trail of the man as best he could, finally finding a heap of clothing that had been slashed. He found tracks outside a window, indicating to him that at least two individuals were present. Eventually arrested for the crime, how exactly he was connected to it, I'm not exactly clear on. It had something to do with a comment made by a previous lawyer of his. Was a 25-year-old black man named Peter Hunter, a habitual felon and burglar. Holland testified that one of Hunter's shoes fit perfectly some of the tracks outside the window, stating that, "I'm satisfied Hunter was the man who was in my house." But such was not the case. Hunter was released for reasons which will soon become apparent. On March 19th, a man was arrested at Tenleytown. He was caught red-handed attempting to gain entry to the home of a judge named Hunt at the intersection of River Road and Rockville Pike, which, as I said earlier, is now Wisconsin Avenue. By dumb luck, a milkman named Charles Wise was arriving at the Hunt house at the same time, and he saw the man sawing at the shutters, the same way Jack usually gained entry. From his initial arrest, police noted that the man, whose name proved to be George Taylor, didn't seem quite right. He seemed to not recognize that he was being arrested until the police were actually leading him away, and it was noted that he spent most of that day crouched on the floor of his cell. He talked in an overly simplistic manner and answered questions extremely slowly. When arrested, Taylor was also wearing some clothing he had stolen from the John Cannon household, as well as a piece of clothing that had been stolen from the Holland household earlier. From Richmond, Virginia, originally, Taylor had formerly worked on the farm of a Mr. Timlick. He buried all the money he was paid by Mr. Timlick, and when his kinfolk saw him going to a stash, they stole his money. Anytime he was confronted about why he stole items, his answer would be either, I can't help it, they took my money, or pleading for the officers not to hang him, fearfully recounting how they hang burglars and robbers in Virginia. He maintained that he had practically no memory of the last few months, and while he could lead officers to various places, he displayed an inability to recall specific addresses. Taylor eventually led police to a stables, in which he stayed much of the time, and in it they found some slashed clothing, some non-slashed clothing, a handkerchief with a monogram A.E. Wall, remember that was one of the houses infiltrated by Jack, and also items belonging to Mrs. Floyd T. Frost, which was another house that had been infiltrated by Jack. Inspector Hollenberger said that he felt Taylor was closer to sane than he let on, and was engaged in some acting. Milton Holland identified some of the knives, of which several were found in the stables, as items taken from his home, and that identification led to the release of Peter Hunter, the man arrested on basis of Holland's testimony. For his part, Taylor seems to have begun to abandon the pretense of insanity as the evidence against him accumulated, and he began leading the police around to his various stashes. Other policemen from Washington had paid a visit to the farm of Scipio Taylor, George's father, who showed them a padlocked chest George had kept there. This was at their home in Richmond. The police forced the chest open and found much of the rest of the loot. In it was many pieces of jewelry, utensils, clothes, and dishes. Several of the pieces were claimed by people who Jack, who we now know was actually George, had taken from the various houses that had been victimized. Police learned of an even earlier robbery, one that had not even been connected with the others, that Taylor claimed that he was also responsible for. In August, he had stolen some silver items from a J.C. Malcolm, who was a railroad employee. He led them to where Malcolm's silver was stashed inside a hollow tree. George Taylor's initial arraignment was on March 27th. Judge Miller was originally scheduled to preside, but this was thrown out as prejudicial, since that judge had been one of the early victims of Taylor. The man pled guilty to the initial three counts, the robberies of Milton M. Holland, John L. Cannon, and Floyd T. Frost. He pled not guilty when charged with the intrusion at Judge Hunt's home in Tenleytown. Judge Kimball, who would replace Judge Miller, set Taylor's bail at $14,000, $1,000 for each charge that was laid against him. His formal trial began on April 9th, and from the outset, his defense was set to bring in physicians to assess Taylor's mental state. Dr. W.W. Godding testified that, in his opinion, Taylor was a kleptomaniac with a mania for destruction. Dr. James P. Halls also testified that Taylor was of low intelligence. On April 13th, the jury retired at 2:20 in the afternoon, and after deliberation for 2 hours, returned a verdict of guilty on all indictments. Finally, on April 21st, Taylor was sentenced to 30 years in prison. He served 3 years in prison, and then in 1897 was transferred to St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Southeast Washington. Here he died in 1927. In a very, very odd postscript, the silver belonging to J.C. Malcolm, which was returned to him following Taylor's trial, was actually restolen in 1911. A thief broke into Malcolm's home, which at the time was in Chevy Chase, Maryland, and stole the exact same pieces of silver. Most were recovered in local pawn shops, but the thief still remained uncaught. I find that little bit very, very strange and bizarre, that the exact same items that had been stolen are restolen. The 1894 history of the police department mentioned earlier also contained a poem about the Jack the Slasher case. The bedstead's on the mantelpiece, the clock is on the floor. The cooking stove is on the roof, the bolt slid in the door. The cat's in the lass's jug, the dog's tail in a loop. The milk's in sister's slipper, the household's in the soup. Police, police, the father cried, come save the bathroom splasher. Too late, it's cut in shreds by Dowdy Jack the Slasher. He fitted on my undershirt, he smoked my cigarettes, he used my well-worn toothbrush, he gave me notes for my debts. He rang the doorbell loud and well, he turned on all the gas. He sat down on the doorstep, he saw the police pass. Police, police, the father cried, come catch the naughty Dasher. I cannot stand the impudence of horrid Jack the Slasher. Jack went into the neighbor house, he heard an awful snore. He didn't stop at anything, he even slammed the door. The tired sleeper lay outstretched, his features drawn and pale. The coat nearby was closely trimmed with knife slits down the tail. The sleeper in his peaceful dream heard no distressful call, and cared less how prolonged and sad was his neighbor's mighty ball. Smiles were Jack's while others wept as he hastily withdrew. So soundly the MP slept, not even said adieu. And that's the end of this episode. A list of sources consulted for this episode can be found in the show description. If you have a question, a comment, or know a lesser-known story that you'd like to see covered, leave a comment on the podcast page. Post it to our Facebook page at Forgotten Darkness Podcast, or send it to our email at forgottendarkness77fd@gmail.com. We're also now on Twitter at Forgotten Darkness Podcast. And so, until next episode, this is Andrew, signing off.